survey statistician at NCHS, National Center for Health Statistics, in the State and Local Area Integrated Telephone Survey Program, which is known as SLATES.
I'd like to start off by acknowledging my co-author, Jim Dahlhammer, who is not here. And in terms of disclosures, I have no personal relationships or any other types of relationships to disclose. And these represent our opinions and not necessarily those of the agencies involved. So I'm first going to start by talking about a tale of two surveys. I'll introduce those surveys, talk about the survey procedures that occurred when Hurricanes Katrina and Rita made landfall in the Gulf Coast. And then I'll talk about the new normal, quote unquote, because we're still working that out in some respects. And then I'll end up with take-home messages. So the two surveys I'm going to talk about today are the 2005 National Health Interview Survey, as well as the 2005-2006 National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs. And the acronyms are there because I'm going to use those throughout. So, oops. All right, so in 2005, the National Health Interview Survey has been collecting data continuously since 1957, and it's the principal source of health information on the civilian non-institutionalized U.S. population. And it's used in many different areas to track trends in illness and chronic diseases and disability, as well as national health objectives like Healthy People 2010. Oops. It covers a broad range of health topics. And it's a cross-sectional in-person survey, which is administered with a laptop. So it's a computer-assisted personal interviewing, or CAPI, mode of data collection. And a key point is that it's conducted by Census Bureau interviews who are managed by 12 regional offices. So in essence, it's a decentralized survey compared to what I'm going to describe next. And that's a key point that did impact survey operations. It employs a complex multi-stage sample design. Now, the National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs is primarily designed to produce estimates of children with special health care needs between the ages of 0 and 17 in each state, as well as the District of Columbia. This is the second survey that I'm going to talk about. Since many of you probably don't know what children with special health care needs are, a quick definition is that these children need or use more medical care or services than are normal for other children of the same age. And they're identified using a consequence-based screener. And this survey characterizes their health and functional status, what services they need or use, as well as unmet needs. And the reason it's important is because it's a basis for federal and state program planning and evaluation. And quite frankly, in many of the states, it's the only source of data on this area. And as well as with the NHIS, this survey also provides trend data. It's funded by HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, specifically the Maternal and Child Health Bureau. Now, this survey is conducted by the survey platform that I work for, the State and Local Area Integrated, State and Local Area Integrated Telephone Survey, or SLATES. And a unique characteristic of the survey platform is that we share the National Immunization Survey, or NIS, sampling frame. The NIS is designed to produce universal vaccination coverage estimates for a rare population of children between 19 and 35 months of age. So we call households, and if a child within that age range in the household is identified, the National Immunization Survey would be conducted first, then followed by screening for whatever SLATE survey happens to be in the field. So this is a telephone survey of landline telephone survey of households, and it employs a complex sample design as well. Now, another key point is that the interviewers are employed by a data collection contractor, and they are centralized at two calling centers, one in Chicago and one in Las Vegas. And this survey was fielded from April 2005 through February of 2007. So you've already seen pictures of Katrina and Rita, and we know what happened. We've heard those descriptions. But what happened after Katrina in terms of actual survey operations for the National Health Interview Survey? Well, first, they immediately ceased data collection in impacted areas. And again, they had to follow, you heard in the last presentation that they had to follow the instruction of local authorities in terms of being able to access the area. And it's important to point out that as an in-person survey, the interviewers who were also residents of the areas that were impacted had issues to deal with personally, in addition to the challenges of their job. So their job is already hard enough to go out and interview people, and then this hurricane rips through and completely demolishes the infrastructure, and it leaves them in a very tough situation. The regional office maintained close contact with the interviewers and the supervisors at all time, and the interviewers had access to a call-in system, which was monitored constantly during work hours. And we heard reports of some interviewers, it would take days for some people to call in. Some people, we understand, it took weeks for them to call in. So that certainly was an immediate issue, because if you don't have any interviewers, you can't collect data, even if you could go out. But in terms of outcomes, as you heard in the last presentation, again, that was for the American Community Survey, so it's a little bit different here for the National Health Interview Survey. But all the uninhabitable units that were affected, that were or would be in the rest of that pot of sample for the 2005 NHIS sample, or if the unit was located in an area that was where the interviewers could not gain access, they were reclassified as out of scope. The Census Bureau, as you heard, does now employ a more proactive approach after the 2005 hurricanes. Although they encouraged their interviewers to have evacuation procedures already thought out before Katrina, they formalized a program to establish emergency plans as well as calling trees to ensure better communication between the regional offices and the field staff. And they also reminded the interviewers to secure their laptops, which they use for data collection. Now, we all know that Katrina was a horrible event, but it does provide some opportunities as well as, we've heard about the negative impacts rather, but it does provide some opportunities for, I don't want to say positive outcomes, but more flexible and creative approaches. So there may be a silver lining in the dark cloud. First of all the surveys that were being fielded faced similar issues, and we would call around and talk to our colleagues and other agencies and within CDC, and we were all stymied by the lack of data, as you mentioned. I mean, we were all in the same boat, so to speak. No one had the answer on how to approach these problems. So these, in terms of a situation where something gets effectively wiped off a map, so to speak, it's an opportunity to be creative and flexible when they rebuild. And same with the survey, because it's a stopping point, so it offers you an opportunity to perhaps alter your procedures, or in our case, to add variables to both surveys. So there were two new variables that were added to the 2005 National Health Interview Survey, which are listed here. So in terms of the National Survey of Children with Special Healthcare Needs, we as well also immediately ceased data collection in impacted areas. Now remember, this is a telephone survey, so it was a little bit easier to manage that process because they can go into the CADI system and take out that sample more quickly than they could do that for an in-person interview. And we used a FEMA line in part to manage and control the field work in the aftermath. Now, I say control field work, it was really more to monitor the rebuilding and the infrastructure status. So this is an approximate geographic boundary to monitor infrastructure losses and reestablishment. And so they use that information in conjunction with data for the infrastructure from local phone carriers and other sources to try to figure out if they could start calling again, where would that be? Would it be in, say, very, very localized areas within, say, a parish or what have you? But data collection restarted in January of 2006. Oops. An important point for this survey that came up as a result of the survey being out in the field was that we found out that evacuation was difficult for some of these children and their families due in because of their special health care need. You know, if you can think of a child who's in a wheelchair or perhaps a child on a ventilator and you have to suddenly, you know, leave your home and go somewhere, where do you go? Because the shelters aren't necessarily set up for people and for children with these types of conditions. So durable medical equipment became a big issue, as well as the electricity to power those pieces of equipment. And again, this caused evacuation difficulties in some areas. So as a result, we added new questions to collect data in an attempt to improve delivery and the level of services for these children. And we assessed the unmet healthcare needs as well as durable medical equipment access among this subgroup, the appropriate shelter, whether they were able to find that, and then where they received their healthcare services. I'll talk a little bit about analytic issues that we had as a survey, running a survey rather in the field as this was occurring. But as I already mentioned, we talked to other surveys that were similarly affected. If you've ever heard of BRFIS or the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, that's I don't want to say a rival survey, but that's you may be more familiar with that than SLATES. But we talked to them. We talked to people in Census. We talked to people across Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And as has already been previously mentioned, we had issues with geography and residency. And what those pre and post cases actually represent was such fundamental population change. We collected data as well from the whole state of Louisiana. So we had to figure out what to do with cases from other parts of the state. So for instance, northern Louisiana, what do we do with those cases? As well as the obvious impacts with waiting and population control totals as well. Do you use the pre-figures or the post-figures? Or it was a cause for great discussion. We also had to evaluate the impact of excluding evacuees to calculate key indicators, not just for New Orleans and Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama, et cetera, but also the states that received those evacuees, so Texas and, you know, they really spread all over the country. So to be fair, you really have to look at all the different states across the country. So we made a decision to exclude the pre-Katrina cases, so cases that were interviewed and completed prior to Katrina landfall, that they would not be included in our public use data file. And those are available, but they're only available internally at the Research Data Center at NCHS. So, what is the new normal? You've heard some discussion of this already, but we really need to be, our thinking needs to be expanded, and it needs to be a multidisciplinary approach to solve these problems. So, we had to figure out, well, what are the criteria to determine whether or not to stop or start interviewing, or to restart interviewing, rather, because you can't just go run out and get a textbook and find this. It's just not there. Now, this is obviously unique to each situation because the infrastructure damage is going to be different depending on whether it's a hurricane or whether it's a terrorist attack or whether it's a flood or what have you. And you really, before you make those determinations, you need to consider the potential impact on waiting and estimates. You know, we were thrown into this situation. We didn't ask for this situation. It just appeared. And we had to really sit down and think about what did we know, what data did we need that we didn't know we needed, I guess is the best way to say it. We also had to work through issues of centralization and decision-making authority. And I inserted this bullet because our survey happens to be funded by one funder, MCHB. But what if you were working on the National Children's Study, where there's, you know, many federal agencies that are working together to complete that survey? And if you have all these different stakeholders and multiple agencies involved, who gets to make the decision? Is it the person who's perhaps providing the most funding? How do you get over those turf issues to make those decisions? And you also obviously have to look at the extent of the disaster and the recovery as well through the infrastructure, and I've listed those here, as well as practical issues like the availability, not just of your respondents, but of your interviewers too, because in our case, for instance, they had to go to work to the calling center. Well, it's not a problem because they're calling from Chicago and from Las Vegas versus the in-person interviewers who do have to go out and they're living in the same milieu as the respondents. So there were survey practices that you might also need to modify, such as interviewer training, and this is something that we struggled with because we want them to be sympathetic and honest, but when you're recalling an area, for instance, you could have potentially distraught or angry respondents. And interviewers aren't social workers, so there's a fine line. And we found that modifying help screens as needed helped because we could provide them with general information such as the FEMA number or Red Cross phone numbers. But as you all know, with the distrust of government after Katrina, that may not be helpful, but they're doing a job, they're doing an interview. So that's really all the information they can provide because they're not clinicians and so. And as well, that it may be an opportunity to add or to modify certain questions on the questionnaire. And it gives you an opportunity to be creative because maybe there's a question you've always wanted to add and you're going to add some other questions about that are probably hurricane or disaster related. So you have an opportunity to add items if desired. But then you also have to consider modifying quote unquote sensitive questions as well. In terms of priority making, I already discussed the decision making and the chain of command. And it's best to try to identify that as best you can ahead of time, especially if you have multiple stakeholder surveys. And we also need to answer the question, are any data better than no data at all? And I put that up because I was just trying to be provocative, but if you have data that have a lot of issues with coverage or you know there's a lot of error in that data, then is that better than not knowing anything? I guess I don't have the answer to that because I think, again, it varies per situation. But as well as the coverage issues that you've heard about and the continuity of operations and the sample. For instance, in our case with the phone survey, we can't call a house if it doesn't exist. And for the NHIS, they can't visit a house if it doesn't exist or unit. So you have to think not just about the survey, the continuity of the operations and the sample as well as the accuracy of the data. So all of these, in terms of concerns, you think about that anyway when you run a survey. And it's hard enough to think through all those issues when you don't have a disruption, much less when you do have this huge disruption that comes in. But maybe perhaps some of these concerns would become bigger issues, such as validity, reliability, confidentiality, and variation of cross-population subgroups, et cetera, as well as respondent burden. Because one of the issues I was thinking about was that if you have, you're really interested in assessing the post-Katrina population, well, so is practically every other researcher in the country, and you have this small group of people, relatively small group of people who remained in that area, and now everyone wants to interview them to assess their mental health or their health care or their telephone service or their whatever topic you're interested in, that could become a problem. Which leads to, I have talked about some of these issues already and they've been covered in other slides, but I did want to bring about the issue that perhaps we need new categories of what non-response codes or disposition codes or resolution rate or response rate calculations. Perhaps we need to be more flexible in those areas. Because really what it ultimately comes down to is decision making in the absence of well-defined norms. In terms of the other issue that we have to deal with certainly as a government survey is Office of Management and Budget Clearance, as well as the IRB, which all survey researchers for the most part have to deal with that. But the logistics of what do you do if a disaster, terrorist attack, whatever happens, and then you have to go out and you want to do a survey, and you have to get these approvals. Well, that's an issue. So perhaps one area is that we could have crisis-ready surveys or procedures and have those pre-reviewed so that if something were to happen, that we could insert them into surveys relatively quickly, in terms of a CADI survey anyway, perhaps not in person, but as well as interviewer and staff issues, just the practical nuts and bolts of getting your data, finding your data collectors and your interviewers and approaching your respondents as well. And then as well as planning for different types of disasters. And I won't spend the time to go over that right now. But in terms of take-home messages, in developing survey designs, We need to build in flexibility and the opportunity to adapt as needed in terms of disaster planning. And I think it's also acceptable to expect to be unable to anticipate all untoward events that could occur during the life of a survey. I think, you know, typically we've been trained that we're given a problem and we have to solve it. We do that in our personal lives, in our professional lives. And perhaps there's some issues or some events, some problems that we're given that require more time, and it's okay that you can't solve it. And it's actually nice to know that your colleagues, that you're all in this boat together and you're all thinking through these issues. As well as adaptations to ensure continuity. So when you think about continuity operations, you need to think about more than just the survey itself, but also regulatory concerns. And when your denominator changes, science is not always clear about what the best thing to do, what you should do, and that at least was our example. And the bottom line is it's only a matter of time before we get to go through this again, sadly. Certainly we hope that a Katrina doesn't happen again in any form, but something eventually, some type of natural disaster will sadly occur that could impact survey operations, so we do need to think about it. And also, no matter how much planning you put into something, it's possible that you're going to have some reactive elements, because you can plan for a lot, but can you really plan for absolutely everything that can happen? Probably not. So maybe it's best to aim for the best damage control possible. And I don't mean that in a way of lowering the bar. I'm not trying to say that. But it's overwhelming when you start thinking about all. I didn't put it in here, but in a previous presentation, I had 6 or 7 slides listed of all the different things that could possibly happen that I had found in different disaster journals. And then if you start thinking about a matrix and trying to plan for sampling and recruitment, and it's a lot to deal with. So some of these slides, as I said, some of this material was from a presentation, Reacting to Disasters, Lessons Learned from a Large Population-Based Survey, that was at the Field Directors Conference earlier this year, ironically in New Orleans. And I want to end with this quote from Albert Einstein, that in the middle of difficulty lies opportunities. So yes, we have this huge issue that we have to deal with in reference to Katrina, but again, whatever the next event that comes down the pike might be, we'll have to deal with that as well. So I think it challenges us to reframe our thinking, because yes, these bad things happen and you have all these negative impacts, but maybe it's an opportunity as well to adjust your surveys. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathy. I think we've heard a lot, that tremendous food for thought here from, you know, a variety of perspectives, and I hope you have some questions or just comments that you'd like to throw out and maybe help generate some conversation here.
In terms of the ACS, as I mentioned, we would like basically to include, because they're not part of the frame that we can go and say, okay, let's include them. I mean, they were not part of our frame. We're trying to be as inclusive as possible. That's what we're talking about, new initiatives with the address canvassing that we're going to conduct now for the 2010 census. So there have been already initiatives to be more inclusive, but definitely that's a challenge.
All right, the only thing I would add is that I can't speak for the National Health Interview Survey, because I don't work on that on a day-to-day basis, but I do work on the SLATE surveys on a day-to-day basis. We do have residency requirements, but if these people who left New Orleans went to a home, and we called that household and say they had children and they had been there for months, they would have been screened just as if they hadn't been there, because they would have been considered residents. Now, if the people went to, say, Houston Astrodome or whatever, or they went to some type of shelter, no, we would not pick them up.
Right, so the Astrodome, they were not there for a long period.
A long period, right.
They were living in these trailer parks for years.
Right. If the FEMA trailer was parked in their yard, similar to what you had said, that would be considered, you know, it's affiliated with that address. For the, maybe it's a messy solution, but that's the only, it's what we could come up with. So, if you have any suggestions, we'd love to hear them.
I think what she's saying is that, like, where you said people set up these trailers in places that were definitely not residential areas,
right.
They were part of parking lots of Walmart or whatever, then
right.
that's what we're missing,
right.
We're losing those
right.
people.
And we acknowledge that we are.
That's part of the challenge.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
Although they were spread across all 50 states, a good portion of them were located in and around southern states like mm-hmm. Texas.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what effort has been done to try and track them and, you know, get the surveys in Texas households to see, you know, where people are, you know, to get you through your survey. Essentially, you're doing one in Texas anyway, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, we would have Texas in the sample, so they would be treated. I mean, the households for that sample would be treated the same as whether they went to Georgia or Texas or wherever.
Possibility of adding some questions to the Texas survey to try and get, I mean, which is valuable information that we need anyway to really know
right.
who went where and how many of them are still staying here. Although Texas can give us some data on that, you know, it would be great for something like that to be included in the national survey.
Right, and I should clarify because this survey I work on is capable of producing both national and state estimates, separate state estimates for each of the 50 states as well as DC. So those questions that I mentioned that were added about unmet needs and durable medical equipment, et cetera, those were asked across the board. And if someone had, we added a question about, I think it was, did you stay away from your household at least one night due to Hurricane Katrina? I believe that was the exact, very close to it. If they said yes to that, then they received the battery of questions. And that was across the board, whether they were in Texas or Georgia or Alaska or Maryland, wherever they went. So we tried to assess that. In terms of the National Health Interview Survey, no, to my knowledge, other than the questions that I showed for 2005, they may have added some in 2006 and 2007, but I'd have to look into that.
We just add one thing about the vital statistics data. We tried to look at what the impacts were for the people that moved to Texas. It's very tricky because, it seemed like a lot of people. It was a lot of people that were affected and a lot of people relocated. But as a percentage of people that already were in Texas, or the events that happened to Texas residents, it's pretty small. And so it's hard to get your arms around what the impact was for the affected people when they really relocated and maybe even permanently relocated to other states. So that's another issue. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, I mean, if people that left New Orleans, for example, and relocated to Houston and decided to stay there and become Texas residents, we can find out about, their births or the deaths or whatever, but they don't. It's hard to say that they're going to have much of an impact. They're not going to have much of an impact on birth, maternal and infant health in Texas because it's such a small number. I mean, it's a big.
Not birth and infant death, but one thing that Texas will say is they have a huge impact on their homicide rate, at least in the first year or two following
right.
Katrina.
Right.
And that rate has gone down now that some of them have moved on to either back to New Orleans.
Right. Yeah. Do you have anything to comment on that?
Well, I can confirm that obviously clear concerns about that.
Right. Yeah. It depends on the event that you're trying to measure, right? Yes?
It's not a specific disaster question, but it's a brain question. There is at least a slow migration away from landlines. Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Are there opportunities?
Actually, my colleague, Dr. Stephen Blumberg, is, I guess, one of the federal experts in that area. And if you want to give me your card afterwards, I can certainly put you in contact with him. We're currently in the process of designing the 2009-2010 National Survey of Children with Special Health Care Needs. And that will be the third iteration, so we do have concerns about trend data, et cetera. So we don't want to do too much experimentation, but we have been talking about possibly adding an address-based sample to that design to help address some of, to help identify cell phone-only households and to get some data from them. But I don't know what the exact status of that. We're still discussing it, so I don't know. We haven't made a final decision yet, but we are looking into that. His research had determined that the cell phone, at least for children, the cell phone population really didn't impact the estimates that much, but it has started to over the last, say, 6 to 9 months. We're starting to see the negative impacts of not including that population.
I'm, of course, not referring to the existence of these alternates. I'm referring to dropping the landline mm-hmm. and can't get households
right.
because there is no landline anymore. Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
Okay. Yes?
Hi, I'm at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston.
Oh, you've got your own.
Post-life world. I'm trying to figure out what information you gave me here today that I can take back and use for a much smaller scale than the national survey. I guess the main question that maybe goes to you, Dominic, about denominator data. What should we be doing now to provide ourselves with denominator data?
I think some of the organizations that are involved in the recovery should collect data out at regular intervals. And in our case, we had different organizations doing it with using different methods. So, Kathleen asked the question, if you have data that and maybe not as reliable as you want, are they still valid? I thought they were incredibly helpful, but at least this gives us an upper and a lower bound of the different estimates. And also, operations like the census, sometimes they're delayed for a long period of time. So having anything that helps in between is just enormously valuable. And the organizations that collect the data can get input from the Census Bureau. And I think we do have this issue of how do you decide who is a resident, who is not, but just being clear about it, I think, is the most important thing. At least if we understand how the data were collected, mm-hmm. it's immensely helpful.
Well, I have a follow-up, because you had said the Louisiana Recovery Authority stopped collecting data in 2007.
I think so, yes.
And that's just because they figure our job is done, we're done,
yes,
whatever.
Yes, exactly.
But what would happen if you took that argument to them? There's no consideration whatsoever, I guess, due to funding, or maybe they go away, or
it's a big issue because we don't conduct a census every year. So mm-hmm. The normal procedure is to just extrapolate to the next
right.
year. And
mm-hmm.
so once mm-hmm. the disaster,
the
recovery is mm-hmm. slowing down, then mm-hmm. you basically go back to the regular methods.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because yeah. you have a new baseline, kind of, and you
right,
work
right.
from that. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Well, I want to thank you all for coming. I think it's been really very interesting conversation here and really good papers, and I thank all the presenters, and I hope they'll take their papers to the next level and maybe try to get them published. So thank you very much.